Superhuman Radio. I've had my BCAAs. I expect my blood sugar to stabilize in a couple minutes. It's amazing, when my blood sugar drops, I find it hard to even think. My next guest has been on the show numerous times, Pam Colleen. She's the author of Addiction, The Hidden Epidemic. I personally think that that is a very, very narrow name for what the book really provides. The book is probably one of the most sensible books identifying cause and effects of nutrition of any book I've ever read in my life. How you doing, Pam?
I'm great, Carl. Thanks for having me on again.
Always a pleasure. You always add something wonderful to the discussion, and I insisted on having you on because we want to talk about school is starting. My own youngest daughter, Sydney, is back, first year in high school. My two older children out in San Diego are back in college. The kids in San Diego, they eat what they want because at the college level, no one's really supplying you, quote-unquote supplying you with food. You're not at the mercy of the school system and what they think you should be eating. You're probably going to the local restaurants and cracking open the books and studying while you're eating something. So it's pretty much in your control. But high school and lower grade schools, the kids can't go out and choose what they want. Parents don't often prepare lunch for their kids. A lot of kids don't want to take lunch because it's embarrassing. Mom, don't send me to school with lunch. You know, I want to sit in the cafeteria with everybody else and eat the slop and the gruel. What's going on with school lunches today? Have they gotten any better? Are they still as bad as they were when I was a kid? What's going on?
Well, I think there's been a lot of initiatives out there to try and improve the quality of school food. There's no question that there's a lot of activism and awareness, and people are talking about it a little bit more. We saw an article in the New York Times just the other day of an initiative, a local initiative, where they're trying to improve the quality of school food. And even Jamie Oliver doing his school food revolution in the United States. He's produced two series on it right now. So we at least we're talking about it. And some changes for the better are happening, where kids are getting more aware of the concept of local foods, whole foods, growing your own food. I think all these are wonderful initiatives. My biggest concern, though, with a lot of these programs is that they're overlooking the importance of animal fat.
Isn't it amazing? Animal fat, animal protein continues to be tabooed. Even my last guest, who was the very, very end of the interview, he happened to mention about milk, and, he says 1%, or skim milk. They already, it's like, even, I know people, Pam, and I'm not going to mention any names, but I know people who, they espouse the inclusion of healthy fats in your diet, but I hear them say the words, well, I don't want to eat that. It has a lot of fat in it. And I think to myself, how can you talk about it, but it doesn't make the connection in your own life?
No, I see that all the time, Carl. They have a disconnect. They have the brainwashing that still demonizes animal fat. They'll take the bun off the burger and eat the burger and not really even, and then 2 hours later you'll hear them demonize animal fat. They don't get the connection. Even through their actions, they will contradict themselves. So that's heavy-duty brainwashing.
Did you actually mean they'll take the bun off the burger and eat the bun?
No, they'll take the bun off the burger and eat the burger.
Right.
But then 2 hours later, you'll ask them about animal fat, and they'll demonize it.
They don't understand that
what they were doing was correct by taking the bun off the burger.
I've come to the conclusion, Pam, and I have to believe that what I'm going to say right now is something that you embody because of the book you wrote. But I have to believe that it takes a great deal of courage to admit that we shouldn't fear animal fat and then to take it a step further to actually eat this stuff. Because I have a feeling, like for me, I have no problem eating fat. Anybody who knows me knows I eat raw unpasteurized butter out of the tub with a spoon. I eat coconut oil out of the tub. I like it when it's hard. I mean, I really walk the walk. I believe that fat is healthy. But I have to believe that there are a lot of people out there who, when they start talking about this stuff or writing about it, they worry. They think to themselves, gee, but what if I'm wrong? What if heart disease is going to, what do you think?
Well, I think that, I mean, the indoctrination into this belief system is very ingrained in society, and people do have to be brave in order to step out of that box.
Yes.
Even in a familial setting, you know, when you're the only one in the family who believes in animal fats, you wouldn't believe the dagger eyes you can get, you know. It's very difficult to override this brainwashing that's going on. And unfortunately, for those who don't get the importance of animal fats, it's to their detriment, you know, and you and I know it. You know, a very select few people. We're a small minority out there, Carl, and you have, you know, you have empathy for these people because you see the mood disorders, you see the sleep problems, you see the overall health problems. You want to help them, but you know the brainwashing is just—it's just too thick.
What is going on with school lunches? Are they, you know, are school lunches still predominantly driven by the food pyramid?
Oh, yes, but even more importantly, and even Dr. Marianne Nessel talks about this, that the school lunch programs have invariably been just a dumping ground for excess subsidized foods like your corn and wheat and so on. So unfortunately, the school lunch programs have been emphasizing way too many carbs for these growing minds.
Mary Nessel is the one who did the about the pet food, the canary in the coal mine. She was on my show, actually.
Yes, and food politics,
yes,
and so on. Yes.
But the other day, Elisa and I, we read a lot of stuff for the show, and I'm going to talk about this on Casual Friday. I could have sworn that she made a statement that I totally disagreed with about school lunch recently. I don't remember what it was, but I feel like it had something to do with fat, that she's against fat.
Yes, she is. She will support sustainable agriculture, and, you know, she's trying to wrap her brain around raw milk. She makes a lot of attempts, and hopefully one of these days she'll see the light, so to speak. But, you know, she still is very much indoctrinated into the mainstream thinking. But she is also a very good advocate for sustainable agriculture at the same time. So
right.
We can't totally, you know,
throw the baby out with the bad word. No, and I agree.
Yeah.
She was on my show. She's a wonderful woman. She brought a lot of important points to the forefront. But there were a couple, she and I did have a little disagreement at the end, and I never make my guests feel uncomfortable, but we disagreed about fat, and she made a comment on my show that, you know, I'm paraphrasing, you know, the fact that we use every part of the animal, is actually a good thing. And I said, you know, some things just aren't meant to eat, and finding a way to use it and feed it to something, whether it's an animal or a human, isn't necessarily a virtue. So, you know, but anyway, with that being said, getting back to the school lunches, are the school lunches completely fat phobic? Are they still following the, you know, the government guidelines?
Even the healthy initiatives, Carl, are still fat phobic and cholesterol phobic. So these poor kids are still on a low-fat diet, even though they may be growing their own fruits and vegetables and, you know, making vegetable soup and making salads and so on. They're still fat and cholesterol phobic, so these poor children are not going to get the nutrients that they need in order to grow and develop properly. So this is one of my main concerns, and I think as your listeners, you know, kind of witness a lot of these changes happening within their districts possibly, you need to police this type of phenomenon. I know when I saw it was Jamie Oliver's first season when he was doing his Food Revolution show, and he was sitting in a big bucket of I don't know what it was, animal fats, a big thing of lard or something like that, and he was, oh my God, you know, we got to watch out for the fats, oh my goodness, these fats are so bad. And he was literally sitting in this big tub of lard. And I thought to myself, Jamie, you know, this is not the message you should be sending, because it's the animal fats indeed that these children really need.
But do you think that in order for you to even have an ability to have a platform in this day and age, you have to kind of go along to get along. You have to agree that fat is bad. Otherwise, you won't even get on the air in a mainstream venue.
No, you won't. And you know, I did a cooking show with a local producer in my town, and we filmed, I don't know, 5 or 6 cooking shows that he was going to pitch to, I don't know, the Food Network or what have you. And I had a you know, a master chef on my side who used to produce a CBC series, a very, very famous cooking series here in Canada. I was sort of it was called the Galloping Gourmet. It was sort of like your Julia Child of
well, it wasn't Graham
Canada. And
Graham
you know what? In the end, he said, no, you know what? He held back. We did all this footage, and he held back, and he said, you know, I just don't think that I think it's too much on the fat. They're going to laugh at you, you know. They're all about low fat. And so anyway, I have all these cooking shows. I don't know what I'm going to do with them now. But
put them up on YouTube. Self-publish them.
Yeah, I could do that.
Yeah,
I could
absolutely.
Do that. But I want to go back. I want to go back to school.
We have to take a break. I'm being told we have to. Here's what we're going to hold that thought. Okay.
Yeah.
We're going to go back to discussing the issue at hand here, which is what your children are being fed in school today. My guest is Pam Colleen. If you want to read an amazing book that will give you a perspective on the cause and effect of diet, of nutrition, you must get the book Addiction, The Hidden Epidemic, and get it at Amazon.com, wherever finer books are sold. When I read this book, I was floored. I thought, this is the wrong name for this book. This book should be called Everything You Need to Know About How to Save Your Own Life by What You Put in Your Mouth. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. To Superhuman Radio, my guest, Pam Colleen, one of the people I can truly say that I learned a lot from reading her book, Addiction, The Hidden Epidemic. You can get it at Amazon.com. It's a fantastic book. Everybody that's ever gotten this book, Pam, has written me an email saying, wow, I thought I was buying a book that was going to teach me how to help people who are addicted to things, and I just unlocked all the things that my diet is doing to my body and brain.
Yes.
Yeah. Amazing.
I actually, that book stems from a seminar that I teach, actually, and it's called How to Fix a Broken Brain. And then basically it's a summary of what I teach in the seminar. It's an 8-hour class, so it's probably easier to buy the book.
Let's get back to the broken brains of young children in an environment where they should be nurtured. The food that they're eating is not necessarily optimal. So let's go back to that now.
Well, let me talk about something historical here. And this is a piece of information that I found in a book that I just happened upon online. It was a book written in 1913. And I can't emphasize the importance of my finding this book, because it really taught me the intention of school feeding in the first place. It was written in 1913 by Louise Stevens Bryant, and at the time she was considered the world authority on school food. So the title of the book is called School Feeding, Its History and Practice in Home and Abroad. And I want to read a quote from this book. I have it in my own book, Addiction, the Hidden Epidemic.
Please.
But in her book, she says, studies of the home diets of children, particularly those who are underfed, have shown that they are deficient in protein and fat. The reason is that meat, fish, eggs, milk are more expensive than bread, coffee, and canned foods. So what they would see in these children who came from low socioeconomic families, that they were buying these substandard foods, that these were the children who had the behavior and learning problems. So what they would do is they would take these children and put them in special schools for 3 months, and it wasn't to discipline these children, it was to nourish these children.
Give them access to better foods.
So they would feed them things like meat and butter, Carl. They knew they needed these foods for their brain to function, for their behavior to normalize. And, of course, after 3 months of nourishing these children, they would come back to school and their behavior would be obviously, you know, dramatically improved. So part of what you have to do, of course, is just educate people. They're not being given the correct information today. They think that eating salads and potentially tofu or, you know, all of these very, you know, nutrient-deficient foods, they're believing that they're nutritious and they're going to feed and support the brain, but it's the actual opposite that is true. If they want to be doing these kids a favor, they should be feeding them high-quality animal foods, hopefully grass-fed if they can.
But you know what? But you know what, Pam? The problem is that the momentum or the gravity of the wrong message, which is taken up, as you just put out, you know, Jamie Oliver and the lard and Dr. Oz and all these talking heads out there, every single day, it's the mantra, low fat, low fat. I mean, I know for a fact that there is a show coming out right now. I'm trying to think who's doing it. Bill Clinton is being interviewed.
Anderson Cooper had him on.
The last heart attack. The last heart attack. And this, their message coincides with these other individuals, forks over knives, who are just trying to Trojan horse slip the vegan diet to everybody. This illusion. And I even had Dr. William Davis on the show, who is a cardiologist and the head of the Track Your Plaque program, who just wrote a book called Wheat Belly, who is saying, look, you know, it may work for some people, but it doesn't work for everybody, this whole vegan approach, you know, the debate, the approach to reversing plaque in the body. And in fact, a lot of the people it doesn't work for. So the point I'm trying to bring out is, in this long-winded way, how do we get people to take the chance on fat and understand it's not going to kill them?
Well, here's what we have to do is, if people are receiving nutritional information today, they have to put things in historical context. In order to do that, you have to look at tribes. You have to look at primitive cultures and study them and see how long they've been following whatever nutritional principle you might be investigating. So, for example, if you're, if you look at a culture, and what you want to do is you want to see if the couples are fertile, if the babies are healthy, if you, you know, if there are any chronic diseases, mental disorders, you want to see and witness that the aging are aging gracefully, that the seniors are still productive members of society. So you want to look at all those parameters, and then you want to study their diets and see what it is that they're eating that would produce such incredible, robust physical and mental health. And so it's the whole diet you must examine. And different cultures, of course, around the world can achieve this wonderful health. They do have different aspects to their diets, but there are still about a dozen fundamental laws. When you study all these cultures, there are about a dozen fundamental laws that adhere to each and every single one of these cultures. And, you know, one of the fundamental laws is that they do eat adequate amounts of animal fats. They eat variable amounts of animal fats in their diet, but it's adequate to sustain them. So in some cultures, it might be 70% animal fat in their diet, and that would be people pretend, you know, like me, I'm of European descent. So my ancestors probably ate about 70% animal fat in their diet, but other cultures would have eaten, you know, even as low as 10% animal fat in their diet. So it's a different, but, you know, those are cultures that it would be from potentially small tribes in Africa or what have you. They're not people that would be potentially from, you know, European descent.
Right.
So we have to be very careful. That's why I know with Sally Fallon from the Weston A. Price Foundation, she says people need to figure out on their own what works best for them in terms of the fat intake. But the vast majority of people that I talk to on the radio, I know that they're going to probably be from at least European descent, and that would be, you know, the higher amounts of animal fat. They should have adapted to that type of diet after thousands of years of, you know, eating that way.
Well, you know, and Randy Roach and I have done we did a show that a couple years ago that, you know, our instincts have been bred out of us. We don't even listen to our bodies anymore. We don't hear our bodies. There's a disconnect. And you're exactly right about this. But I want to also point out something else. I attended a webinar last night at Life Extension Foundation about food sensitivities and food allergies. And the reality is that aside from the fact that people are eating way too little fat to sustain normal cell development in the brain and nervous system function and so on, they're assaulting their bodies with foods that actually overstimulate the immune system, increase inflammation, exacerbate the nervous system, and actually over time chip away and chip away at the way the body functions, including the brain. And I'm talking about, you know, over indulgence in grains and in soy, and God knows now genetically modified foods we won't know for two or three generations. And I don't think you have to go back and even look at primitive societies to unlock this answer. Those of us who are European, like myself, remember how our grandparents cooked. My grandmother had a jar on the back of her gas stove that she used for renderings. When she cooked something and there was fat left in her skillet, she poured it into that jar. That jar filled up and it got white and it was filled. And then she would take a spoon and dip into it and throw it back into the frying pan and cook with it again. So we embraced fat. You know what? My grandmother and grandfather did not die of heart attacks.
No.
My great-grandparents didn't die of heart attacks. I know this. You know what? We need to just look a couple generations back and look at the way they embraced fat. They were cooking with lard. They were frying bacon in lard, for crying out loud. And nobody was having heart attacks. This is evidenced And you don't have to go very far. Just look at the message that Dr. Paul Dudley White gave. He's the guy who started the American Heart Association.
Mm-hmm.
He said that heart attacks are on the rise for one reason only. The reliance on corn oil and hydrogenated oil, because that's when Crisco came out in 1910, and the overabundance of refined sugars in our diet. And he told people, return to animal fats and beef tallow and raw unpasteurized milk. Return to these things. This is where, when we were eating this way, there were no heart attacks. No one cares about that. No one wants to admit that that's the truth.
Well, it's hard because, again, with commercials on TV, I mean, that's what people are being bombarded with on a daily basis. And secondarily, Carl, they don't have perspective in terms of the history. You have to go back into history. They didn't eat lard for just one or two or three generations. This was something that they would have eaten for thousands of years.
Right.
And yet, you're right, just over the last 100 years is only when we've seen the rise of the edible oil industry and in the introduction of these types of foods is what we see in terms of the destruction of our health, both physical and mental. So it's really very basic, but unfortunately people don't go back in history. They just look at the moment and don't have any way to measure that. You know?
What are the ramifications? What are the ramifications of current school lunches? A kid goes to school, let's say he has a good breakfast. Let's say it's one of our listeners. So the parents prepare eggs and maybe some sort of animal protein or some cottage cheese, a good, healthy, high-fat, high-protein meal. The kid gets to school, 4 hours later, walks into the lunchroom, and is faced with pizza, macaroni and cheese, some sort of goulash that has a couple pieces of beef, and the rest of it is a roux of flour and gravy. I mean, what happens after that meal to that child?
Well, you know, what's going to happen is the brain doesn't get fed. They're not going to have the nutrients in order to properly feed the brain. And depending on how many carbohydrates would have been in that meal, of course, they're going to have a blood sugar roller coaster ride for the afternoon. So they're going to get sleepy. They're going to get listless. They're not going to listen properly to the teacher. It causes a lot of mood problems to not properly feed the child at lunch. And unfortunately, because of peer pressure, of course, they're going to potentially just only eat junk food, whether it's pop or juice or potato chips or french fries or what have you. So, they're not going to be able to concentrate for the afternoon.
So the magic question here for you, and we have to take a break, but what I want those of you who are listening to this show today who have children, I want you to ask your child today, tomorrow, the day after, not about school lunch. Don't say, what did you have for lunch? Ask them this critical question. Say, how did you feel after you ate lunch yesterday? Did you get sleepy when you eat lunch? Oh, yeah, Mom. Oh, yeah, Dad. I can't keep my eyes open after lunch. Do you have a harder time concentrating? Do you do better at classes before lunch or after lunch? Ask these questions. Don't ask what they're eating at lunch. Ask them, how do you feel after you eat lunch? I have a funny feeling, Pam, that the answers are going to not surprise any of us. Kids are going to say, I feel like going to sleep. I fell asleep in math class and got a detention because of that. It's not the kids' fault, folks. It's the school system. They're feeding them stuff that doesn't work for their bodies and their brains. Now, when we come back, I want to address the next step in this, which is we have to take control of what our children eat for lunch, and we're probably not going to get the school system to work with us. So you're going to have to start preparing your kids' lunch. We're talking with Pam Colleen. She is the author of the fantastic book, Addiction, The Hidden Epidemic. This book unlocks a lot of nutritional answers for those of you out there searching for a more fulfilling life. You must get this book. It's a great book. We'll be right back. To Superhuman Radio, we're talking today with Pam Colleen. This song was written by a guy who obviously is not getting enough fat in his diet because he's suicidal. We want to help avoid that happening to your children.
Mm-hmm.
After lunch at school. So
they're going on that the bad mood roller coaster ride from eating too many carbs and not getting enough animal fat in their diet. So we just had a hockey player here in Canada commit suicide, and he was only, I think, 27 years old, and I hate to think what happened with regards to his diet, potentially. What would have potentially, led to that in terms of brain starvation and making the wrong decision there. You know, and speaking of that, with depression, and antidepressants, Carl, you know, one of the side effects of taking antidepressants can be homicidal and suicidal thoughts.
Right.
So, you know, why don't we just not have to deal with that in the first place? Let's feed the brain the fuel it needs in the first place so that we don't have to go to that extent and take drugs that could mess us up.
Well, and you know what? You know, we talk about supplements, but supplements are just fractions of real foods. And there's research that shows that supplementing with fish oil because of the omega-3 fatty acids in it is as effective at mitigating major depressive disorder as several SSRIs. So what does that tell you? If a fish oil supplement can make someone have a sense of well-being, as good as, if not better, when you think about it, because there's no side effects to it, there's no build-up time, you don't have to take it for 3 weeks, and keep in mind that SSRIs only work for about 50% of the people that they're prescribed to, so they need other products to dumb them up even more so they don't know they're depressed anymore. It's like, it comes back to nutrition. It comes back to nutrition.
And in Ireland, Carl, when they banned the hunting and the fishing, and you know, basically, if you were caught hunting and fishing, you would get the death penalty.
Really?
From the monarchy. This was, I think, in the 1800s, and it was after they banned the fishing that you start to see the rise in alcoholism in the Irish. Of course, I'm Irish descent, so you know, I know the reputation of the Irish and drinking. But at any rate, yeah. So they were deprived of the foods that would have made them feel happy, you know, naturally. And unfortunately, this led to depression, which led to the drinking. And, of course, the drinking would have exacerbated the problem. So, we know about the importance of feeding our brains the fish oils. And even more importantly, in my opinion, of course, is the cod liver oil. You know, the fish oil is giving us the omega-3s that we should be getting from eating fish and grass-fed meat and dairy products and so on in the first place. But what's really difficult to get enough of course, is the fat-soluble vitamins A and D. So, and the cod liver oil will give you the vitamin A and D, but also you will, through the processing of that oil, you will get some small amounts of the omega-3s as well. So I prefer the cod liver oil simply because it's kind of like getting a two-for-one deal.
I am a staunch advocate of cod liver oil. I abandoned just plain old fish oil for cod liver oil now. Because of the importance, I recognize the importance of vitamin A. And this is especially for young children, for stem cell differentiation as their bodies grow. We know that vitamin A is a hormone, just like vitamin D is. There's a symbiotic relationship between A and D, and you should supplement with A and D together. And one good way to get the A portion of it is a cod liver oil that has a 10-to-1 ratio, and then you add a little D to it to just kind of boost it. But you're absolutely right. I am on the cod liver oil bandwagon now. And I don't tell people to get fish oil anymore. I say get cod liver oil.
Yeah. I don't mind if people use fish oil short term to catch up, but really we should be getting those the omega-3s from the meats and the high-fat dairy in the first place. But I want to go back to something I learned recently, Carl, that kind of shocked me, and I think your listeners need to know about this because I hope this doesn't become a trend in our schools. I was doing a book signing recently, and teachers were coming to see me at the bookstore and basically warning me that they're being instructed to go into the children's school lunch and count calories. And they know that this is wrong because they know that the calorie theory is a myth, and we really, you know, if obviously the more nutrient dense the food, the more calories are going to be in there, and these are the calories, of course, that our brains desperately need.
Right.
And I was absolutely appalled that teachers were being instructed to do this. These are people who are not doing, you know, what we're doing in terms of our due diligence, in terms of studying nutrition. These are teachers, and you know, and obviously, I'm not, talking down to them, but they really don't. This is not their area of specialty, is nutrition. If anything, they're being taught on nutrition is, you know, Canada's Food Guide or the Standard American Diet or what have you. They're not being taught real nutrition. They're being taught what the lobbyists want them to hear and what the politicians are now instructing them to do. And I'm appalled by this. And if it's going on anywhere else in North America, people need to stop this practice because obviously by counting calories, that means the kids are not going to get animal fat. And Michelle Obama just so people know, Michelle Obama is on the low-fat bandwagon, and she is part of this whole idea of taking out the animal fats from school food. So,
but see,
somebody needs to get to her to educate her.
That's what I was going to say. But the problem is this: we don't have the team support on the high-fat side of the table. The low-fat diet has everybody in the world promoting it, and there is no one out there that is really saying anything different. How do we get spokespeople who have the kind of weight that the low-fat diet people have to start talking about the importance of fat? And then we're going to be bashed. Look what they did to Gary Taubes on Dr. Oz, because he's promoting fat, and Oz is going, "Oh, fat's no good. Fat's no good." You know, it's like. Mm-hmm. But how do we change the tides?
Well, it is, the tide is turning. I mean, I don't know if you've seen that recent video online from Dr. Diamond. He's a new kid on the block, so to speak, that's out there promoting the importance of animal fat. And it was because of his own personal experience that he, you know, was being instructed to eat a high carbohydrate, low fat diet, and his triglycerides kept going up and up and up and up, and he kept getting fatter and sicker, and you know, having more depression or whatever the case may be. And all of a sudden, he said, "Okay, I'm going to take the bull by the horns," and he started doing his own self-study. So now he's on our side. Now he understands the importance of a traditional diet. But, you know, they're going to keep getting sicker, Carl. Like, people always tell me, you know, "Who starts your car in the morning, Pam?" Because they're all worried that somebody's going to try and assassinate me for saying these things. And I say, "I'm not worried, because they're sick, and they keep getting sick."
Right.
And if they're not sick, these people, their family members are sick. So they need eventually to hear what we have to say, Carl. I don't worry at all, because, you know, our chief medical officer, the CEO of Pfizer, the CEO of Johnson & Johnson or Eli Lilly, if they're not sick, somebody in their family is sick.
Right.
And they have to eventually come around. And it has to happen sooner rather than later.
Let's talk about, before we go into the next break, let's talk about what parents should be doing. If your child says to you, "Yeah, Mom, I definitely am so tired after lunch. I just want to go to sleep. I can't think. I'm foggy eyed." So you need to convince your child to start taking lunch to school. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, taking your own homeschool. Yeah, that's the way it's been done in Canada for many, many years. It's a little different system here. The parents are supposed to theoretically give the kid their lunch to take into school. So our school food programs are nowhere near as expansive as in the United States. And I think that's really the parents' responsibility. It should go back to that type of system. Because right now, nationally in the United States, the program is not working. It's sustainable for shareholders or what have you, but it's not sustainable at all for the children and their brains. So, you know, making sure that you educate your children, you motivate your children, that you give them the foods that are nutrient dense, but the ones that they also, you know, that they're going to eat, you know, that they're going to enjoy. You know, a beef burrito, for example, or sausages, or possibly high-fat cheeses. There's all sorts of information through the Weston A. Price website that will give you recipe ideas. I have some of those links on my website. So you have to get creative, you have to educate your child, but you also have to make sure that they don't think that these feelings that you just described, Carl, are normal. And unfortunately, this sluggishness, the lethargy, the anger, the moodiness, whatever, that is all being normalized. And I think one of the things we have to do as a society is realize, you know what, because the fact that your child can't get out of bed in the morning, it's not cute. It's not funny. It's something very serious, and
right.
It is a big, loud, glaring red sign. I speak to that simply because I was bedridden for 12 years with chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia, multiple chemical sensitivities. I was on death's door for 12 years. So when I hear that somebody has trouble getting out of bed in the morning, to me, I say, you know what? Look at the nutrition. Look to the adrenal glands. You know, look to the entire biochemistry and fix it. And the only way really to fix that core problem is through good nutrition, and that must include animal fats.
You know what's really funny? It just dawned on me, and this is an overgeneralization that I'm about to say, but it just dawned on me. Countries that have siestas or afternoon naps, Italy is one of them. Mexico is another. These are societies that place a great deal of importance on high carbohydrate intake.
Mm.
Am I off base with that? Is that an overgeneralization?
Mm, Yeah, I'd say because some of those, the countries you just mentioned do eat adequate amounts. Again, it has to be the term adequate amounts of animal fat. I lived in France for a year, many, many years ago, and of course their diet is, again, has adequate amounts of animal fat, and they do the, they used to do the siesta. I don't know if they're doing it anymore. So yeah, you know, there's, I'd say in, even in Italy, they're eating sausage, they're eating meats, they're eating high fat cheeses. I mean, they're getting adequate amounts of animal fat in their diet. It's true that they've moved towards a lot of pasta. But that's really in reflection to, you know, wartime eating as well in terms of diluting the meats and making meals go longer and so on.
Some
of these countries had to do that.
Right.
In order to feed large.
Yeah, and I knew it was an overgeneralization. I was just searching. I was just thinking about, you know, I'm always connecting the dots in my head. I'm trying to connect the dots in my head. When we come back, I want to ask you some questions about fibromyalgia. I know it's a little off base, but, talking about nutrition in general, whether we're talking about what to do for our children's health or what to do for our own health, it's all the same. We're talking with Pam Colleen. She is the author of an amazing book that you must get called Addiction, The Hidden Epidemic. You can get it at Amazon.com. Don't let the name of this book fool you, folks. This book is about the cause and effect of nutrition and how it affects your brain. It all starts there. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. To Superhuman Radio. My guest is Pam Colleen. Pam, I didn't realize that you suffered from fibro.
Oh, I was deathly ill, Carl, for about 12 years with all those conditions, chronic fatigue,
fibromyalgia. Now, obviously, you were being treated by doctors at that point.
Well, initially I went to doctors, but I got fed up with them because even the one doctor I went to, you know, the person I went to see who I was told was a specialist and an expert and so on and so forth, I found out that she herself had chronic fatigue. And I thought to myself, why am I going to this medical doctor when she's probably even sicker than I am?
I love that. You know, I've actually asked on this show, I've asked physicians who I've had on this show, if you are searching for health, would you go to a doctor who clearly is unhealthy? And I've had some doctors say, absolutely not. I've had some doctors say, well, yes, because the answers you're looking for may not be. You know, I actually said one time on the show that before you go to a doctor, you should find out what medications he's on or she is on. Because if you go to a doctor who's taking a statin drug, a blood pressure med, an antidepressant, an anxiolytic, it's like, forget that. This person is going to just prescribe all those things for you because that's what they did for themselves.
Well, and you know, the sad thing is, you know, these doctors are out there trying to solve the mystery of fibromyalgia, and they think they have it. You know, they're prescribing Prozac, they're prescribing God knows what drugs, and don't know anything about nutrition, of course. And women especially are hit with this illness, men too, but it's mostly women, and they're so desperate to feel even, you know, 10% better. That, you know, the second they have any attention given to them, and that might be in the form of getting a prescription, you know, they unfortunately lead on their lives thinking, well, I feel 10% better and I should settle for this because this doctor wrote this prescription for me, and this doctor knows so much, claims to know so much about fibromyalgia, and unfortunately these women go 40, 50 years suffering with the side effects of the drugs or the side effects of not having the proper nutrition. And I see this all the time. I see women who come to me in their 70s and they've been sick for 50 years, Carl, and tried doctors and tried medications, and unfortunately the systems that they sought out made them much, much worse because they never understood the fundamental cause of fibromyalgia, which is essentially deficiencies and toxicities. And I know that sounds very vague, but, you know, when I work with people, I know, you know, the biochemistry, I can look at the biochemistry of an individual. Fortunately, I have a great testing system that I use. It's not expensive. The whole program I do is not expensive because most of the people I work with are usually on death's door. The people I work with, Carl, some of them can't even leave their homes every day. They're dealing with severe depression, severe chronic fatigue, severe obsessive compulsive disorder. You know, I see the worst case scenarios, Carl, and these people have fallen through cracks in our medical systems, be the system in the United States or in Canada, so whether it's a socialized system or a privatized system, they are simply not getting the help that they need because simply people don't understand what fibromyalgia is. And I've been through it. I've, you know,
well, let me ask you some questions.
I know it can be reversed. It is not an incurable
condition. Let me ask you some questions because I... fibromyalgia, are you constantly in pain when you have fibromyalgia?
Usually, yes, and the pain is usually very systemic in most people. You just touch some of them, you just touch their forearm, and they cringe in pain. Sometimes the pain can be more of a deeper kind of arthritic pain, and usually there's some sort of either depression or fatigue attached to it, but not everybody with fibromyalgia will admit that. They push and push and push themselves through the day and do what they can just to function.
I've noticed that women who suffer from fibromyalgia tend to crave sugars, and they eat a lot of candies. And I mean, I know one person that I've had this discussion with, and I know many people that I've spoken to about this, but there seems to be a craving of sweets. I don't mean bread. I mean outright candy. Did you have that at all when you had it?
Well, I made the mistake of becoming a vegetarian. I made the mistake of becoming a vegan. So I may not have been eating your obvious carbohydrates, like your sugars and so on, but I was drinking lots of carrot juice and eating lots of salads. And, you know, I was just grabbing for different kinds of carbohydrates and continuously, unfortunately, kept malnourishing myself. I was already starting off malnourished, and I ended up exacerbating the problem.
How long did it take for you to turn the tides for yourself once you started to look at your nutrition as potentially being...
It took me 12 years, and, you know, it was a 12 long years of struggle. I mean, I made a lot of mistakes along the way. I spent thousands of dollars, went to all sorts of special clinics, followed all these fad diets, and most of what I did actually made me sicker. And so I'm really fussy on what I choose right now in terms of helping people. I always tell people, if it's expensive or complicated, then it's probably not good, because those are all the systems I did back in the 90s when I was sick.
Yeah. So once you unlocked the secret for yourself, how long did it take for you to turn things around?
Well, the one secret that I didn't know about was the importance of animal fats. And when I started eating animal fats, that really, really helped turn my situation around. And then when I found the program that I have right now, too, this really helped refine things for me, and that I had to understand the importance of the mineral balancing. So I had to, and this sounds very complicated, so I don't want to dwell too much on it, but it has to do with adrenal function and how the adrenals control the balance of minerals in your body, and on top of that are also in control of your body's ability to pull out the heavy metals. And so I have to refine, with the people that I work with, I have to refine their sodium to potassium levels, calcium to magnesium, zinc to copper. Those are the three main ratios I have to look at, and I have to fix those. And fortunately, that is a very simple thing that I can do with people to help achieve that goal. And as they work with me, their cobwebs start to clear up. The brain fog starts to go away. They start to think more clearly. They start to have more energy. The program I have does not work overnight. It takes several months to get the biochemistry back. So the program I have requires patience. But the people who come to me, Carl, are the ones who have done what I did. They spent thousands and thousands of dollars, got absolutely nowhere. They go into these systems thinking that there's a silver bullet. There is no silver bullet. It takes work to turn the biochemistry around. So, I fire people that I'm working with if they're not doing the program. I'm like Sergeant Pam. You know, if you want to get well, then come to me, yes, but expect to do a lot of work in order to turn the situation around.
You know, Nick Guggs just posted on my Facebook about schools are taking a fresh look at cafeteria food and from scratch meals. Well, and that may be all well and good, but the very, very first thing that they depict, they have a picture of a lunchroom worker. She's a 32-year veteran lunchroom worker in Greeley, Colorado, and she's mixing, and they're talking about this as being like a positive thing, mixing beans with cheese and seasoning for burritos. No mention of meat in that burrito at all.
No, and that's where we could be fooled down the road by these healthy school food initiatives. We need to be very, very diligent. We need to make sure that there's some meat in with those beans, and high quality meat, hopefully. The kids are on high fat dairy products. So yes, it may look good on the surface, these school food initiatives, but as with anything, buyer beware.
Yeah. It's not enough just to reduce sodium and sugar and things. It doesn't matter what you're reducing. If the children are not getting the adequate amounts of animal fat and protein that they need for optimal health.
It's so Orwellian. I mean, really, I went into a high school recently, and there was a vending machine there with a logo on it saying, if you choose the foods with this logo on it, they're the healthier choices. And
right.
I mean, Carl, I wouldn't feed those foods to a dog. I mean, you just, they were not healthy.
Yeah, I know. It's a very sad situation. But again, parents, take control. If your children feel that they're somehow embarrassed to bring lunch with them to school, find a way to overcome that notion, because you're much better off sending your child to school with a lunch that you make at home than subjecting them to the stuff that they're going to eat at school and then be sleepy and sluggish after lunch and do poorly in those classes after lunch. You know, we know that lunchtime changes the way the brain functions. There was a study done on judges. Judges rule differently on same type cases before lunch versus after lunch. Now, I'm not saying that it was better or worse, but it was clear that after a judge eats lunch, his brain functions differently. He evaluates things differently. The same is true of your children. Give them a running chance at doing well in school. After lunchtime, I remember as a kid, after lunchtime, I wanted to go to sleep when I was a kid. I remember that. I remember wanting to I remember coming back from the lunchroom and sitting down and feeling exhausted and thinking, oh my God, I can't wait for the bell to ring for us to go home.
Yeah, but you know what?
Sleep.
People, adults are looking at that behavior and thinking, oh, isn't he cute? Isn't that cute? Well, you know what? When you talk to somebody today in their 80s and they remember their childhood, that's not what they witnessed. These kids had energy. They had respect for their elders. They were excited to learn subjects at school, even geography and history. I mean, these kids were sponges for information and had energy. When they woke up in the morning, they jumped out of bed feeling refreshed and excited about the day. And unfortunately, our kids are just not feeling these feelings today, and we have to stop normalizing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's time to do that. And one of the things you can do to help better understand how nutrition, the role of nutrition in brain function and your child's ability to learn, is to buy the book, Addiction, The Hidden Epidemic. Do not be confused by the name. In this book, you will learn the relationship between brain function and nutrition. And this is all good stuff. You need to know this sort of stuff for yourself, for your child, and forever. Hey, listen, Pam, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me on, Carl. I appreciate it.
Okay. And we also want to thank, look at this. See, I didn't eat today. We want to thank Bob Whelan, author of Iron Nation, Passion for Hard Training. Thanks to Randy Roach for sending him my way as well. We've got an amazing Casual Friday planned for you tomorrow. Elisa Profumo has been working feverishly to find examples of nutritional idiocy, and I think we're going to have a chance for me to rant tomorrow for sure. We'll see you tomorrow.